My name is Bill Lawrence. I'm the Dean at Perkins School of Theology. My role is to introduce to you our two speakers. I'm going to give you some background information about both of them, and then they are going to come and speak in sequence without further introduction. I will tell you that just before I came up here to begin the proceedings today, one of the speakers, I will not tell you which one, asked if they could reverse the order so that he could go second rather than first and rebut. My suggestion was that we consult according to Torah, Urim and Thummim, which seemed to be a good idea, especially because nobody knows exactly what those things were on the breastplate of the high priest. There's the other option, and that's to go with the NFL, which is you can kick, receive, or defer. I chose, in regard to the speaker's inquiry, to defer. So let me introduce them to you as their information appears. First, I want to say a word to you about Morton Meyerson, and then I will introduce John Holbert. Morton Meyerson was born in Fort Worth. He played football and wore the same number that his father wore when his father played football, 72, at Paschal High School. He went on from high school to the University of Texas in Austin, where, in addition to pursuing his Bachelor of Arts degree in economics and philosophy, note the combination, economics and philosophy, Mort Meyerson was active in the student choir and fraternity life and student government, and he played intramural football. In 2005, the University of Texas at Austin recognized him by granting him the Distinguished Alumnus Award for the university. He graduated from Texas and then went on to active duty with the United States Army with an occupational specialty involving automatic data processing. After he was discharged from active duty, he remained in the active reserves with the United States Army. Meanwhile, he began his career in 1963 at Bell Helicopter. Then in 1966, joined Electronic Data Systems, ultimately becoming president and vice chair, managing the entire cohort of 45,000 employees. He also played a significant role in the sale of EDS to General Motors, which resulted in his becoming the top technology officer at General Motors. From 1971 through 74, during his tenure at EDS, he was chief executive officer and chair of DuPont Glorfogen, a Wall Street brokerage firm. And I've heard him talk some about his experiences living and working in New York. I'll just summarize that part of his biography to say he's really happy he's in Dallas. In 1992, at the request of Ross Perot, Mort rejoined the corporate world as chief executive officer and chair of Perot Systems. He continued to serve in that capacity until retiring again in 1998. He is chief executive officer and chair of 2M companies currently. If you see a pattern here, the pattern may be that he flunks retirement because he has continued to be active in so many ways. In 2007, he was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences class of fellows. On a personal level, he and his family have a strong and profound belief in the Jewish philosophy of tzedakah, the Hebrew word for just and righteous giving required by the religion. Also on a personal level, I want to tell you about his family. His had three children, Leslie, David, and Marty. Leslie and her husband, Rob, and Marty and her husband, Jamie, have three children each. He enjoys spending as much time as possible with his six children. His son, David, is deceased, but his spirit is carried on by Mort and his family. I want to introduce to you a very special guest, and that is Mort's mother. Ms. Meyerson, let us greet you. Currently, in addition to his work with the aforementioned 2M companies, Mort serves on several private and public boards, and he sings bass with Morris Beachy Singers and with the Dallas Symphony Chorus. So if you were wondering what our two speakers have in common, the commonality includes at least two things. They both know a lot about the language Hebrew, and they both know how to sing. John Hulbert has been a member of the Perkins faculty for decades. In fact, he has spent most of his life here. And it's up to John to tell you why it is that he came here in the first place, but suffice it to say that it wasn't because he was a deeply committed, deeply called to ministry Christian. There were other reasons, and he'll share them with you or not. John Hulbert earned his undergraduate degree at Grinnell College, then came to Perkins School of Theology, where he earned his Master Divinity degree, and then stayed to continue working on his PhD. His PhD actually was the result of a fascination that he developed in his first few weeks as a Master Divinity student here at Perkins when he fell in love with the Hebrew language. His teaching specialties as the Lois Craddock Perkins Professor of Homiletics focused primarily on preaching, but also on Hebrew Bible literature and preaching. His research interests specifically focus on preaching and the Hebrew Bible, but also on fiction and religion and storytelling. His publications have run the gamut from preaching the Ten Commandments and preaching Job to Psalms for Praise and Worship and A Storyteller's Companion to the Bible, focusing on the book of Genesis. John is an ordained minister in the United Methodist Church, a clergy member and ordained elder in the Central Texas Conference. He's the editor, co-editor of a journal, a professional journal in his field that is called Homiletic. And he has not only had a career as a teacher of preaching, he's also been a practicing preacher in a number of settings, specifically in some very challenging pastoral appointments when he served for a year as interim senior minister at First United Methodist Church in Fort Worth and interim senior minister for a year at First United Methodist Church in Dallas. I invite you to welcome our two speakers today, Mort Meyerson and John Hulbert. We'll begin with Mort.
Thank you for that warm and generous introduction. I've been thinking about what I was going to talk about today for 5 months. John Castle sent me an email and asked me if I'd speak. I asked him what subject. He said, faith and how it's influenced your personal life and your business. I immediately said yes, and then I started to regret it. Because this is a very personal subject with all humans, and with me it's particularly personal. So in order to not be too serious about it, I thought I would tell you the gathering here at the Perkins School, the seminary. The last time I was so close to something like this was in 1954. When my teammates at Pascal on the football team, we went to church every Sunday. Fort Worth, as you may know, is a very Baptist-oriented town. I only knew one Methodist. And he was one of my best friends, and he used to take me to the church downtown in Fort Worth, and I'd listen to Gaston Foote, for those of you who would remember Gaston Foote. Anyway, we went to church. We never went to temple or to synagogue because I was the only Jewish football player. And in My father, as you know, played football at Pasco. He was a starting lineman and played drum in the band. It's a strange combination. He would march on the field and play in his uniform. So he was like ambidextrous or something. Anyway, we used to go to church, and this group reminds me of this particular event. We went to Broadway Baptist. It's a huge church. And we all sat in the rows with one another. I guess I should divert. One time we went to a church next to TCU, and they passed the host and the little cups of wine, and I literally said, "You have snacks?" They certainly don't do that at the temple I went to, Bethel. Anyway, so back to Broadway Baptist. So there I was, sitting with 90 football players, and I was sitting between my two best friends, Arthur Baird of Baird's Bread and Bill Frost. And I had never been to this particular church, and it was big, and they did the service. And at the end, we had a call for Christ. For those of you that don't know what that is, people would march down to the front and make a declaration. As they did that, my two teammates put their legs under mine and shoved them so that I stood up. And there I was, standing for the call for Christ. So I walked down to the front. So I'm partly with you guys. That's taken me longer than I expected. Okay, so I want to start by saying that my family, two families, my mother's and my father's families, are immediate immigrants. My father's parents immigrated from Russia, leaving religious persecution in 1890 and 1892. And my mother's family came from Germany, leaving religious persecution and early pogroms, which were done in 1830 and 1840, in that time frame. They went to Kansas City. My father's family, the Meyersons, went to Fort Worth. And I can't tell you how grateful I am. I think about my grandparents going into the West, to the unknown. Nobody spoke the language, had no money, nothing. One family arrived in Galveston, and the other family arrived in Ellis Island. My grandfather was 14, walked by himself 300 miles from Russia to get to the port. So I am heavily influenced by my family, my grandparents. I was very close to them. I was also highly influenced by my friends, albeit they were virtually all Baptist. And so I lived in three different worlds. My one grandparent set were Orthodox, kept kosher, spoke with a broken accent. It was very difficult for me to understand them sometimes, although my grandfather spoke seven languages. English was his poorest version. And he worked and walked to work as a tailor for like 50 years. I was heavily influenced by them. Just one thing about my grandfather used to give me, I used to go spend Sunday with the Meyerson grandparents, and he would give me a quarter, which was like a fortune in those days. And he would give it to me in nickels. And he said that I should take one nickel of the quarter and put it in the charity box, the tzedakah box, because that's what we did. And that was I was like five or six. That's my earliest memories of my grandfather. My father if you give that he graduated from high school in 1929, had no ability, the family had no money, had no ability to go to college, and took a job for $5 a month, the fact that he was able to get me into the University of Texas and paid for my tuition, et cetera, is quite an amazing story. But the thing I first remember about my dad was in 1943, we were at the train station. One of my uncles was being shipped off to the war. And there was a restroom that had colored in white, and there was a drinking fountain that had colored in white. And I was 5 years old, and I said to him, I don't understand this. And he said, well, the law is that if you're colored, African-American, Negro, you have to drink water over here. And I said, why is that? And he said, because that's what the law is. But I want to tell you, Morton, that we don't do that. That is not our style. And you must show respect to anybody. And while it is the law, we will follow the law. As a family, we don't do that. Now, that stuck with me all of my life. My mother, I'm 73 years old. My mother still bosses me around. So what's new? She also bosses Tom Luce around when she wants him to give speeches. I would summarize my mother's influence on me. In the ninth grade, I was an all-district football player, and we were graduating and going to Pascagoula in the 10th grade. There were five junior high schools that fed in to one high school. And I, in that summer, I was very hesitant to go to... I wanted to play football at Pascagoula because my father had, but I was very hesitant about it because I didn't know whether I could be first string. And I told that to my mother. I said, I think I'm just not going to do this because I can't, you know, there'd be five, there's actually 10 players that play my position. And I don't know that I could be first string. And she said, well, you know, maybe it'd be a good idea. Why don't you just try it? Go up there for a week. And if you don't like it, then quit. But you don't quit before you start. And by the way, it's okay if you fail. Now, I have taken that lesson all through my life of trying things, even though I might fail, and fail I have. And I won't go into those stories because it'd be too depressing, and John wouldn't have anything to talk about. Now, I'd like to shift my focus a little bit from family stories and my background to some lessons that I've learned and maybe the practical side of it. One of the fundamentals of Judaism is the protection of dignity. Now, in recent times, I have read some texts that I didn't know about that I'm going to reveal to you because I think there's a message in them. The first one that I didn't know about is that while the highest calling for a Jew is to study Torah or the five books of Moses or the Hebrew Bible and learn from it, there is an equal obligation to teach your son a trade. Now, this is being violated by certain groups in Israel now who spend all their time studying Torah, and the government supports them, etc. So I don't want to get into the Israel kind of like splinter group. But I didn't realize until a month ago when I read this in a text that you're required to teach your son a trade so that he will not be a person on the dole or receiving tzedakah, because That's the way you protect his dignity and the dignity of the family. I found that to be fascinating. There's a lot of discussion about taking care of the poorest, neediest people in society. I was in Israel in 1998 and studied tzedakah, or required giving, or charity. And I did it with a rabbi privately who sent me to a library where I spent about 3 or 4 days reading the original text from 2,600 years ago. And I came back from that experience, and I'll just give you one example of it. If you're, remember, this is an agrarian, 2,600 years ago, an agrarian society. Basically, everybody were farmers in Israel. You were required to leave the corners of your fields unharvested so that at night, people who were hungry could come and harvest for themselves, called gleaning. Now, many of you know about gleaning, but did you know that this was the root of it? And if you are harvesting and grain or fruit falls from your hand and lies on the ground, you can't pick it up, and you are deleted for the gleaners. And they come at night. Why? To protect their dignity so that people don't know that they're needy. They don't have to announce it. Our foundation was set up on these kinds of principles. And I was with a group on the outskirts of Jerusalem where we, our family, supported a man who supported people who were hungry. And he invented a card that looked just like a credit card that the people used to buy groceries so they wouldn't be embarrassed when they went through the line and have to show their I'm on charity. So those kind of things are very important. I want to say a word about the Yetzer HaTov and Hara. So I'm sure most of you are familiar with this term, or maybe not. All right, Yetzer in Hebrew means inclination. Ha means the, and Tov means good. And hara means evil. So if you put that together, it is the inclination for evil or the inclination for good. Now, this is a very different idea than original sin. And there is a separation here in Judaism and Christianity, which is telling me I'm about to go too long. There's a separation, but one of the things that I have been impressed with in my study of the original text is that the calling to go for, to promote your inclination for good is all over the Bible, all over. But it gets deeper when you get into the commentaries. And basically, the commentaries say, hara, evil, is a more powerful force than good. So your task in life is to bend the evil force for the benefit of good. Now, I'll just give you one example, which is pretty obvious, but it's kind of strange. All humans have a sex drive, and it can go off in the wrong direction, and particularly with teenagers and so on and so forth, it's got a lot of bad implications, anti-family, pregnancy, so on and so forth. If you bend that in the proper direction, it leads to procreation. And procreation is how we live in our families. That's just an example. I won't go into others. The last thing I want to talk about is if you were to say bumper sticker Judaism, like picking a few things, one of the phrases you would stick up is choose life. Choose life. It says right in the Torah, choose life. Don't choose death. Don't choose suffering. Choose life. And it runs deep all through Judaism. In war, Jews are not allowed to desecrate the bodies of enemies who are killed. If people are executed as criminals for murder, you're not allowed to display the body. You must give it respect, clean the body, and bury it quickly. Those things are subsets of Jews' life. Now, I want to just go into one difficult subject for me in choosing life, and that is the death of my son in 1998. It echoes the loss of my brother in 1949. I was 10 years old. I had no idea what my parents were going through. To me, it was like I knew what the death in life was, but I didn't understand my brother's death, and he had been sick for 3 years. My mother nursed him at home for the last 18 months. When he died, I can remember being in my room thinking, I'd just as soon never come out. I'd just as soon curl up in a ball and be silent. I don't ever want to come out again. Now, the Jewish tradition requires, if you follow it, and many people don't, sitting Shiva. Shiva means seven. For 7 days, you're required to have a gathering in your home or temple or wherever, but generally in the home. People bring food. People's prayers are said. And I didn't understand it, and nobody had said Shiva in my family for 50 years. But I said, we will sit Shiva. And we did. And what it did is it forced me to leave my room, go downstairs, be with people, study Torah, study Talmud, and be part of the community. And I realized in doing that, this was the heart of Judaism, which is forcing yourself back into community. Now, the phrase that I have always enjoyed about Judaism is good things are wrapped in bad and bad things are wrapped in good. It's somewhat like the Yetzer Hara and Hatov story. But if you can take the bad things that happen to you and turn it into good, then you're on the right path. And I have endeavored to do that since 1998. So I will close by quoting myself 30 years ago. My grandparents left Germany and Russia, coming to Kansas City and Fort Worth, rather than complaining or kvetching about their life over there. They came to America, the land of freedom, and lived the American dream, and for that I am grateful. So in spite of what's going on in the United States today and in the West, we have challenges. I look forward with optimism, believing we can do better.
Well, since I'm sure you're all anxious to find out why I came to seminary after Bill set me up that way, I'll tell you. I was not raised in the church at all. I have no church background, and my wife and I, who is sitting here of now 42 years, 40 years, not terrible. You see, this is what I have to live with for 42 years. After about our fourth or fifth date at Grinnell College, she said to me, "Well, you know, John, I like you a great deal, but I could not marry anybody who wasn't a Methodist minister." And the call of God got very loud at that moment. And here I am. Actually, what she meant was she wanted to be a Methodist minister, which she finally became. But that was later, because there weren't any models in those long ago days. But now there are a fair number of models, thank goodness. Well, thanks, Mort, for that. I must say to you that I've enjoyed so much getting to know Mort a little bit in the last few weeks. It's been a real pleasure for me. He's a fascinating man and a delightful conversation partner. We do share something else besides our bass singing voices. We also share the love of Hebrew. I've had a love affair with Hebrew and Judaism now for over 40 years and have spent a lot of my time thinking about it and all they do. When I first was introduced to Judaism in 1968, which I knew absolutely nothing about, but the person who introduced me said to me, "Well, you know, where two or three rabbis are gathered together, there are four opinions." And I knew I was in the right place, for sure. Well, I want to say just a couple of things about some of the things that Mort said, and I want to use the biblical tradition to do that, and he's already referred to a couple of these things, but I want to say a few things about both tzedakah and also yetzer. Tzedakah, of course, as he said, is in Judaism the loosely rendered, I suppose, charity. That's not quite right, as he knows perfectly well. It means the responsibility that one has to care for those who have so much less. This, I might add, is the same in Islam. One of the five pillars of Islam, of course, is zakat, which is precisely the same thing, the need for the gift of charity to those who have much less than you. I want to show you a couple of places just to describe where this idea of tzedakah began in the Hebrew Bible, and I've got several texts. I know you've all brought your Bibles, so... I know you haven't. I'm just joking. Just joking. In Deuteronomy 25, Deuteronomy is a very significant book in Judaism, of course, but in Deuteronomy 25, in the 13th verse, it says, "You shall not have in your bag two kinds of weights, large and small. You shall not have in your house two kinds of measures, large and small. You shall have only a full and honest weight." And the word honest there is translated now the word tzedakah, actually. It means that justice, just dealing is desperately important in Judaism, desperately important. And there's a hilarious scene in the book of Amos, the 8th century prophet in the 8th chapter, where two men are sitting in the back of the sanctuary in Samaria, and they turn to one another and they say, in effect, "When is this windbag priest going to shut up so we can get out of this place and go back and cheat people some more by making the weight small and the ephah great," meaning that they're ready to take advantage of people as rapidly as they can. No wonder Amos was furious with Israel at the time, because he had good measure to be so. But Deuteronomy 25 suggests, of course, that this ancient way that weights and measures are important. And Mort's already mentioned Leviticus 19. Those of you who are Christians, you know Leviticus 19. You just don't know you know it. That's where "you shall love your neighbor as yourself" come from, Leviticus 19. Jesus didn't make that one up, by the way. He got that from his Judaism, okay? Just to be clear about that, all right. Now, Leviticus 19 has in the 15th verse something very interesting. "You shall not render an unjust judgment," that's the word again, tzedakah. "You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great." That is, Judaism was intent on getting justice and clarity and honesty at every point. And so if you couldn't find honesty in the courtroom, you couldn't find it anywhere. So the worst thing you could do was to bribe somebody, to bribe officials. Obviously, it happened all the time. I suppose that's why they talk about it so much. But it means that tzedakah also means honesty, straightforwardness, trustworthiness, all those sorts of things. And as Mort said, that leads to the notion of dignity for every human being. Every human being, poor or great, deserves equal access to tzedakah in the tradition. And this goes into government and law, again in Deuteronomy 16. And then in Jeremiah 22, a 7th century prophet in the Hebrew Bible, there's a marvelous passage which I want to share with you, because it really does make the point of tzedakah, I think, quite clearly. It's in 22. Jeremiah was a prophet in Judah for about 40 years, a very long time. And he was desperate to describe to people what was most significant in their lives. They had really gotten confused about this, frankly. And when the great king Josiah was killed in the year 609 by the pharaoh Necho as the armies came down the Mediterranean coast, and for some reason Josiah tried to stop them, didn't work, he was killed. And it was a tragedy. And then his son, whose name was Jehoiakim, became the king, and he was, to put it bluntly, an idiot. And also a rather ugly kind of idiot, too. And he proceeded to decide that the best way to live was to just oppress people and to make all the money that he could. And he had some young bucks who told him that was a very good thing to do. And Jeremiah became very angry indeed. And this is what he said. "Are you a king because you compete in cedar?" It's a wonderful phrase. "Because you can build great buildings? That makes you a king? Did not your father eat and drink and do justice and tzedakah, mishpat with tzedakah, then it was shalom with him. He judged the cause of the poor and the needy. Then it was shalom. Is not this to know me, says the Lord? How do you know God? By doing justice and righteousness. This is the prophetic call for 300 years in Israel's history. And of course, the most famous example of that is the passage from Amos, which you probably have heard if you've been to Atlanta. On Martin Luther King's catafalque there in Atlanta, Amos 5 occurs, and it's passages that some of you have heard before, and it goes like this. I hate, I despise your festivals. The word there is hog. It means pilgrimage feast, basically. I take no delight in your solemn assemblies, and even though you offer me your burnt offerings and grain offerings, I won't accept them. And the offerings of your well-being, your shelamim, and your fatted animals, I won't look upon. You take away from me the noise of all your songs and the melodies of your harps. Let justice roll down like waters. There it is. And tzedakah, like an everlasting stream. The statement that Amos wants to make is, God is known and wants to be known by our doing of justice and righteousness, not by great assemblies, great worship experiences, great prayers, and all that stuff. Ultimately, Amos says you can pray until you're blue in the face, but if there is no justice in your society, the prayers are irrelevant. It's a very blunt and series of things, but this tradition, you see, of tzedakah, this tradition of righteousness, this notion of being responsible one for the other, is deeply rooted in the Jewish tradition. Now, a couple of words about Yetzer. The word Yetzer is usually translated inclination, although sometimes it's translated purpose even. But there's something other interesting about this word Yetzer. That's the noun. The verb Yatzer, from which it's on which it's based, means to form or to shape. For example, in Jeremiah 18, Jeremiah is asked by God to go down to the potter's house to find out what the potter's doing so he can understand what really is happening in Israel. It's a metaphor about shaping and destroying and reshaping. And the word that's used over and over again is yatzer. It means it's an artisan word, essentially. So when one thinks about the purpose of one's life, according to the Hebrew Bible, one is also concerned with the shaping of one's life. And Mort said this. That is the notion that there is in all of us, Judaism says, a Yetzer Tov and a Yetzer Ra, the good and the bad inclination. And the bad one is very powerful indeed, as he said. But the purpose, the inclination that one has, is also to shape and form one's life. Now, there are hundreds and hundreds of stories that the rabbis love to tell about the responsibility you and I have to live in the world. And I could tell you many, but the one that always sticks in my mind is this one. Three rabbis are discussing a question, and they are arguing vociferously, as rabbis tend to do. And they are shouting back and forth at one another. And if this is true, one of the rabbis says, then may my arm fall from my shoulder if this isn't true. And the other rabbi says, well, my position's not true. May my head fall right off. And the other one says something like that. And finally, God appears and says, that one's right. And they all say in chorus, you keep out of this. And what that means, of course, is that you and I are responsible. We're the ones responsible. The favorite story in the Hebrew Bible that the rabbis love is the story in Exodus chapter 32, where Moses argues with God about the people of Israel. They built the golden calf. God is furious. Get out of my way. I'm going to kill them all and start over again with you. And if Moses had a half a brain in his head, he would have said something, well, whatever you say, boss. I mean, after all. Or when God says, I will make of you a great nation, maybe he should have said, oh, good idea. Oh, you missed one over there. Get him. There he goes. But the fact is, what Moses says is something quite extraordinary. He says, wait a minute, God. Don't get so hot here. What will the Egyptians think of you? It's a rather odd argument when you think about it. They're supposed to be face down in the sea. But nonetheless, what would the Egyptians think of you? Or have you forgotten your covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? How far be it from you to do such a thing as this? And the text tells us that God changed God's mind in response to the power of Moses' argumentation. Well, it's an extraordinary tradition, isn't it? And you can see in the life of a person like Mort Meyerson how much this has meant, this notion that inclinations of good and bad make up who we are, but we must choose, as he concluded by saying, from Deuteronomy. I set before you this day life and death. Choose life. Thank you, Mort, for the fine comments you made. Thank you. All right.
I'm going to invite Mort to come up. Now, we've had the philosophical foundation laid. Now is our opportunity together to reflect critically on what they've said and put that together in terms of how we think and how we're shaped and formed in our own life experience. So we are recording the sessions. If you have a question, I'm going to come and bring you the microphone so that we make sure we get the questions, because later we may want to listen and reflect deeper. So questions for Mort and John.
And let me say one thing. Mort has urged me to say this to you, so I want to say it too, and that is two things. First, if you have a question, make it one question.
Thank you.
Yes. One question, not questions sort of put together or something like that, one at a time. And secondly, if you want to make a speech, go on the campaign trail. But here, ask us a question.
Okay.
Rena.
I'm not sure I'm following directions. I'm wondering, what is your prayer life like? What works for you? What is your prayer regimen?
I wish you hadn't answered that. Asked me that. I have extreme difficulty with ritual and service. I'm ritual challenged, so I don't really routinely go to the synagogue or temple for services, nor do I routinely pray. And this has been true ever since I've been a small child. I did the obligatory go to the religious school, graduate, you know, I've done all the things. I tend to go on the high holidays, and we always have a Seder. But I have great difficulty with that. And in that great difficulty, I followed what my grandparents and parents told me, what I perceived to be my responsibility. The first time that I had money that was exceeding what we had to spend for the kids and the family, I called first the temple, then Federation, and then city charities, and gave money. But that didn't really work for me, and eventually I got into the study of text, and it started in 1996. I won't go into that story. It's fascinating to me. It's almost like accident. I don't know how this happened. It happened. And I got interested in the study of text, and as soon as I got interested in the study of text, I knew this is where I should be, and this was my calling. So I study text generally in a group, rarely by myself, and in studying text, that's my prayer.
There's a long tradition of that in Judaism. You know, the reading of Torah is prayer. That's a very common way of thinking about it. You know?
Okay, we've got one right here.
Maybe you might throw up a fluff ball. So.
Something easy. Something easy, huh? Yeah.
This is based on, if I understand the story that Mr. Meyerson said correctly, it sounds like the lesson to teach your son a trade in Judaism is not a very well-known lesson. It sounds like you just discovered that recently. So my question is, why is that such a secret? And I'll violate the assumptions by further asking, does that have implications beyond the son to extended family or society in general?
All right, I'll answer the second question first. It was stated as son because in the time period that the texts were written, you always talked about the son, and it was a male-oriented society, even though women basically dominated as usual. But that's the way the language went. But any contemporary interpreter of these ideas would say it would extend to daughters, it would extend to extended family. So it's not limited to your son, but that's the way it was said. Now, when I said that I was surprised to discover this. My surprise was to find it so clearly done in text where some of the Haredi or ultra-Orthodox Jews have chosen to skip over that and go straight to study of Torah is a full-time job and there's nothing else. I just didn't know about that text, but I knew about the concept because the echoing my father's words and my grandfather's. My grandfather said, "We are Americans. You will learn English. You will be our first college graduate. You will be the first military officer. We are loyal to this country. That's your job." My father said, "You will marry, you will have children, you will raise decent kids who will be a great part of society, and you will provide a living for them." It was very clear. There was nothing ambiguous. That was my mission. And so while I learned it, I didn't know the text. That's what I found a month ago.
If I could just add something to that. In this claim, of course, about teaching children Torah is, of course, rooted in Deuteronomy. And ironically enough, as Mort probably knows, that in the phylacteries that some very Orthodox Jews wear, little boxes on head and arm, one of the texts that's always in there is precisely that text from Deuteronomy 6. It's the one about how often should I teach Torah to my children, whenever I rise up, whenever I walk in the way, etc., etc., etc. So the implication is that one is required to teach Torah to one's children. That's what it says in Deuteronomy clearly. And so it's a rather ironic, it seems to me, that persons who have this as part of their own long, very Orthodox tradition would sort of miss that as a significant part of the tradition, since it is at the center of it, according to Deuteronomy 6, anyway.
I have another question right here.
Thank you. I am curious to know, at EDS and in your church service, for both of you, when did you have an important decision that your faith strongly influenced?
I'm going to let you go first.
I go first, yeah. Well, as I said to you, since I wasn't raised in the church at all, I have no church background, really, and I didn't go to church till I was in my 20s, I really didn't get faith, any sense of faith, until I came to seminary. And it was basically in a class in Hebrew. I began to read these texts, and these texts were speaking to me in ways that I couldn't even have explained probably at the time. That somehow, when I came to seminary, as I said to you, because I wanted to marry this woman, but more than that, I had this vague notion that I should be doing something for the world. What that meant, I don't know. I didn't even know. But it seemed to me that when these texts began to speak to me, and I, within the first 2 weeks of this class in introductory Hebrew, we were reading the book of Genesis in the language. That's the way we were taught inductively. And so the very first verse of the book of Genesis spoke to me in a way that nothing really quite had before. I wanted to be an English teacher all of my life, basically, and I was a voracious reader of all things like that. But this stuff somehow, and I couldn't even tell you exactly how it did, but over time, after the language became more and more part of who I was and the culture and the history, etc., it became very clear to me that that God was saying something to me about my responsibility to transmit the traditions of the faith. And so it became important to me to become a person who could do that. That's why I spent all these 105 years in school, so I could learn how to do that. And here I am. I'm still doing it, both as a pastor in some cases and then also as a teacher for all that time. So it began for me here, actually, in 1968. I could pretty well define sometime in those months faith became important to me.
All right. That question is kind of goes to the heart of what I perceive to be the purpose of these sessions. And I actually had thought about it before I came in here. It was on a cheat sheet they gave me and said, maybe talk about that. I chose not to talk about it because I had a lot of other things, but I will talk about it now.
When you're in an organization, you will see things, or I saw things, that I didn't think was right, I didn't think was fair, I didn't think protected the dignity of the people. And when I became a leader, I set about trying to correct those, making my own mistakes and doing the own, I had my own negative times, etc. But I remembered the phrase, do this, God says, because once you were slaves in Egypt.
Right. Good.
That phrase is very powerful to me. It says, remember where you come from. Don't get too excited with being the CEO of something. And when I retired from EDS, I retired for many reasons. One of the reasons was I grew weary and tired of some of the things that I saw. I saw embezzlement, I saw fraud, I saw drug use, I saw trading sex, I saw rapes. These things rise to the top, and I can tell you stories that would maybe make me sound better than I am. I just did the best I could in those circumstances. The case I'm going to give you is one that is more real to me because there's no clear answer. And those situations where there's no clear answer and you have to do things or you feel that you have to do things that pulls you in two different ways is very difficult. In 1971, I became at age 33, with no background in finance or business, I became the CEO of a Wall Street firm. Perot invested a lot of money. He looked for a CEO, did searches. Nobody would take the job because it was a nightmare. And he turned to me one day and he said, why don't you move to New York and become CEO, which I did. We did a lot of things. They did an audit. We were $86 million out of balance. It was a nightmare, an absolute nightmare. The pressure, it was like kind of 2 years ago when they had the crisis and everything with the mortgages. It was like that plus some. I had been CEO about a week. Somebody walked in my office and said, I need an authorization to buy two cases of bourbon. I said, what? He says, we need two cases of bourbon. I said, number one, I am the chairman and CEO. And what are we talking about here? It's like, I be the king. So I'm sitting there saying, what kind of question is that? They said, well, we need your authorization because we're afraid. I said, okay, what are you going to do with the two cases? And he says, well, we have to give it to the telephone repairman. I said, what? Have to give it to the telephone repairman so they will connect the wires because we just came in and we need to have it in trading. They go down in a manhole and they won't do it unless we bribe them. Now, put that in front of you. I was the new CEO. We have to have communications. We can't get it done unless we give them the cases of liquor. I decided to do it. And in parts of me, I regret doing that. In other parts of me, I understand sometimes you're called to do things that are difficult and there are no clear answers. So that's my answer to your question.
Good. Got another question right here.
I'm going to fight very hard not to give you a speech. My apologies. You challenged me a lot today. I don't like you, I don't know why I'm here, what brings me here. But I am a Muslim, and my parents are Palestinian. And I love what I have heard from you about Judaism and the teachers of Judaism. And I have been involved in interfaith for so long. And I have been impressed with the commonalities between Muslims and Jews and Christians and Buddhists and members of other faith. My question to you and my question to myself, how do we bring justice to a situation that has been going on for as long as I have been born? You mentioned 1954, I was 3 years old, and I'm still living this situation. And the whole world is still paying the price for a very, very sad situation that involves a huge deal of injustice. Please forgive my emotion, but both of you, you challenged me quite a bit. Before I opened my mouth, I recited the prayer of Moses when God chose him to go to Pharaoh and tell him to free the slaves and let his people go out of Egypt. I said in the Quran, Rabbi shrah li sadri wa yassir li amri wa hlul 'uqdatan min lisani yafqahu qawli. My Lord, ease my burden and get away the knot in my tongue so that I communicate what I need to communicate and they understand where I come from. Thank you both for this very enlightening presentation today.
Well, part of me would like to defer because I do not speak Arabic and I have not studied the Quran extensively. I have studied the Quran, but I don't consider myself to be an expert. But I will speak about what I perceive to be your fundamental thrust is. What is going to be the solution between the situation of two peoples, the Palestinians and the various versions of Palestinians and the Israelites? And the answer is, I don't really have a clear answer for that. I have been very upset over a long period of time of the actions on both sides of what I see. What I see are rockets being shot into Israel, bombs and terrorists blowing up children, and it's just beyond me to think about that. Then I see things on the other side, the same thing with war that goes on. Israel is a very powerful military country, and I can't get excited and I can't condone all of the behavior of the Israelis either. And until such time as the two peoples talk with one another, I don't really see a solution. I don't see it out of the current government in Israel, nor do I see it in the government of the Hamas or the PLA. I don't see that leadership, and frankly, I don't see it in the U.S. either. So there are no leaders who will take this on in a fundamental way to get resolved, because the similarities between Muslims and Jews and Christians is very high and the differences is very low. But right now, the differences are emphasized.
Well, I don't have anything much to add to that. I think that's right. The times I've been to Israel, I must say that I'm often told when I'm there that a lot of, low-level discussion is going on all the time between Christian Jews and Muslims. There's a lot of meetings that occur regularly in houses and in hotels and all over the place. So it's not that people don't talk to one another. I think they do. But I think Mort is certainly right that the governments, it seems to me, those who are making these large decisions, seem neither to have the will nor the skill to move that beyond than just having little talks with one another. That finally won't do it. We're going to have some serious give and take, some serious discussion among these groups before anything's going to happen. And I absolutely agree with you. This is a tragedy of the very first water. And I pray every day for all of the peoples who are involved in this really monstrous situation.
We have time for one more question.
I'd just like to add a sentence that I know that was difficult for you to stand up and say what you say. And Moses did have a thick tongue, and nobody knows if he had a cleft palate or he was slow of speech or he was just shy. And in your case, I think you ask a very powerful, very important question. I just wish we had better answers.
Yeah, indeed.
One more.
Or maybe not.
Maybe not.
Well, let me ask the last one then,
okay,
if I may.
Good. Sure.
So this idea of bending towards either the bad or the good, those are, as Bort, you said, these are experiences that you personally encountered in your own business leadership world. Could we put a little finer point on that, though, and talk about, as we leave here today, when we go to our respective lives of living, interacting with folks, leading businesses, could you each reflect on what you think the call of Scripture is in terms of how we think about what we do every day in business? What should we be focused on? The bending? The justice? And how does that fit with the other demands that we have when we're running our own businesses? The stakeholders that we encounter every day that we have to answer to. How do we negotiate that? And what's the calling for us in Scripture, whether it be both Old Testament, New Testament, Hebrew Scripture, New Testament Scripture?
Well, I'll speak only on one half of that question. I do not know the New Testament well enough to speak intelligently. One of the issues that I have faced personally is I'm a person that likes binary or clear situations. I was trained as a systems engineer. I took great joy when you write software for business or for nonprofits. It's a very interesting thing because it either works or it doesn't work. If it works, you're thrilled, and if it doesn't work, you're unhappy and you fix it. I lived in that world for a very long time, and I took great satisfaction. As I rose in the organization, became a leader, things didn't turn gray, they turned complex. And you didn't have either or. Now, in machine language, you write in binary generally, although I once wrote in octal. When there's a language that has three instructions, it's either, or, and. There's an instruction in the computer that says both. And I have tried to navigate the space by putting in my head one extreme and then the other extreme and try to stay away from going to the miserable median in the center and stay with a continuum in my mind. And it's very hard to do. That's been one of my greatest challenges. And also not to expect quid pro quo answers, results. Our family trust invest, not gives money, but invest in people. There's a group in South Dallas. We invest in 12 kids who will graduate from high school and go to college. Their children will go to college and have jobs, and their grandchildren will. And that's the only way you can change things. I don't think there's any solution to poverty, hungry people. The scriptures tell us there will always be hungry people. That doesn't excuse us from doing something. What it basically says is we have to, but don't expect an immediate result. And that's what our foundation and what I've been trying to do.
Well, I remember when I, in 1968, when I came here, some of you in this room will remember Rabbi Levi Olin, who was one of the great characters in the city of Dallas, a magnificent human being. He used to teach here regularly, actually. And I took a class from him called Understanding Judaism. And I remember one of the things he said, which I've never forgotten, and that was this. The problem with you Christians, he said, is you have too low a tolerance for ambiguity. I think that's right, actually. I think what Mordechai just said is exactly that point. That is, you get to a certain, the more you find out about things, the more you know how complex things really are. It's only those whose sights are limited and you can reduce ideas to bumper stickers who really don't have any problem with any of this. This is right, this is wrong. And all of us, I trust, and anybody who's lived for 5 minutes in the world with their eyes open, knows that the world is a very complex place, a very ambiguous kind of place. But that does not mean that one is not directed by the kinds of things that Mort's been trying to say. That if tzedakah, righteousness, sits at the basis of the universe, then it is up to us to move toward righteousness. And finding out what that is at every moment is not very easy. There's always struggle with that. And that's why you study Torah in a group, because people need to talk to you, and you need to put you back on track, and you need to think about what they've said, and then you go back and forth. So the community of like-minded, good, righteous people, I think, can help us move forward in ways that sometimes it looks so difficult for us. And granted, certainly the world in which we find ourselves now, conversation is minimal, to say the least. And I think we need to make a judgment for ourselves that we want to have conversation of value. And that means a conversation based on these basic principles that both Judaism and Christianity and Islam have at the center of their lives. So I can hope that we can do that. That's certainly my optimism. I believe at the heart of the universe there is a great God who loves us. I believe that as sure as I'm standing here. And that means that I cannot be pessimistic. No, there is no such thing as a pessimistic Jew, Christian, or Muslim. We believe that God is on our side and loves us. And so for me, that's where we have to start, I think. Thank you.
John Mort, thank you very much.